From Autosport.com and Autosport Magazine, I'm Kevin Turner, and this is the Autosport Racing Podcast. Well, it's the start of June, which means only one thing in the world of sports car racing, and that is the Le Mans 24 Hours. And we're going to start our build-up with this episode by talking to somebody who has, well, he's already got a remarkable sports car CV, which we'll get into in a moment. Welcome to the Autosport Podcast, Nick Tandy. Nick, how are you doing?
Yeah, good, thanks, buddy. We're just prepping before scrutineering and getting ready for the test day. So, yeah, it's all guns blazing, I guess.
Yeah, so Nick is already at Le Mans, he's just said there, but our other guest hasn't bothered to get there yet. He's still at home, but he will be getting out to Le Mans fairly soon. And that's Gary Watkins. Gary, how are you?
Yeah, not too bad. Just about to finish this podcast and then start packing and leaving to get to Le Mans sort of late-ish tomorrow. So I'm there in situ for the test day, you know, the first track running of the Le Mans meeting on Sunday, which is a bit shorter this year, actually. Only two lots of 3 hours. So were you aware of that, Nick, that you don't get so many?
I am now, Gary.
Yeah.
I hadn't noticed the difference in the schedule, actually, but
he just does what he's told, gets in the car exactly. When he's told to get in the car.
You don't get a lot of laps on the test day anyway. So.
Well, I know. And it's a lot of them are pointless early doors, aren't they? Because It's quite dusty, the circuit. Although over the years, they clean it much better for the beginning of the day on the Sunday, I've found. Like, you don't see those big sort of rooster plumes of dust behind the cars.
Yeah, that's right. Like you say, I remember coming here a few years back and it was the whole morning, you know, it was just kind of track cleaning stuff. But even last year already, I think we were sort of representative already in the morning. So
yeah,
they must be doing more work. Good old French.
Yeah. Well, let's get onto some of the detail of why we've decided to speak to Nick this week. And that's because, well, first of all, Nick Tandy is the only person to have won outright the four big 24-hour races, Daytona, Le Mans, Spa and the Nürburgring. But also, Nick, you've had an unbelievable year already in IMSA. You've won Daytona, you won Sebring. You won 3 out of 5 races so far. But with winning Daytona and Sebring, that means that you could do the Triple Crown in one season, which has never been done before, and only 10 drivers have done it in their careers. So, I mean, does that kind of add pressure, add excitement? Oh, it's a pretty cool thing to be able to talk about.
It's a cool thing to talk about, you're right. I mean, it's an amazing thing to talk about, even, you know, to be thinking about, well, like you say, having won here before, I'm already a member of that club, which is just an unbelievable thing. But does it add pressure? Does it change anything? No, it doesn't, because, you know, any race you go to, you want to win. Le Mans, if you win Le Mans, you've won Le Mans. You know, if you look back afterwards and say, yeah, Christ, we've won all three big races in the same season, it's just something extra. But I think that's something that you kind of look at afterwards. You know, coming here, it's the same as if we go to Detroit or if we go to Petit Le Mans, or, you know, each race, of course, you want to win and you focus singularly on that race, of course. What you then look back on, and like, you know, the stuff, the whole being the only person to win the four major 24 hours, it's an incredible thing to look back on, of course. Unbelievable. But at the time, you know, you just focused on each single event, of course. So it's good that we get to talk about it, though.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
If I could just butt in, you know, as Kevin said there, you became the 10th driver to do the Triple Crown when you won. And we're talking about the outright Triple Crown, and we could go into the Class Wins Triple Crown, which you actually did some time ago.
Yeah.
But yeah, to do the outright Triple Crown, you sealed at Sebring, and there are only 10 drivers, and some, you know, some fairly heavy hitting names have done it, you know, like like Jackie Oliver, Al Holbert, Hurley Haywood, our own Andy Wallace, and sort of more in more recent history, Timo Bernhard. And perhaps it's almost interesting to say who didn't win it. You know, people like Jackie Ickx, who was regularly doing all of the races, but never got that elusive Daytona 24 hours victory. And now someone's going to be listening to this and go, hang on, didn't Jackie Ickx win Daytona? Well, yes, he did 1 year, but it was during the fuel crisis when the race was of a much shorter duration, just 6 hours, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
Sounds like some of the Nürburgring races recently.
Yeah, good point. But it wasn't sure. It didn't set off being a 24-hour race. Yeah. They always knew it was going to be 6 hours, unlike the Nürburgring, when the red flag comes out after 19 or whatever hours. The intent was to go to 24 hours. And I guess we should mention someone like Tom Christensen, you know, of course, the record winner at Le Mans with 9 and also the record winner at Sebring. And he's won those two twice. Three times in the same year, but never Daytona, because he never went to Daytona, because in sort of pretty much during his career, there was a sort of schism in North American sports car racing, which meant Daytona was part of a different championship, you know, ALMS for Sebring, and Daytona was part of Grand Am, and before that the USRRC. So it's really interesting, and it is a select club that you are a member of, and you're almost like about to become sort of club captain, aren't you? Well, if you do the calendar year Triple Crown, then you become the club captain, I think.
Well, we'd add another name though, wouldn't we? Because then Felipe would get it as well. So we'd be co-captains.
Yeah, co-captains. That's a good point. Yes, that's good. That's a good point. Yes. But so there you go. Yeah.
I think before we get on to the season so far, I'm just going to, sorry, you'll have to indulge me here, Nick, but I'm just going to go through the kind of the classics that you've won. So 2013 Petit Le Mans GT class, 2014 Daytona 24 Hours winning the GTLM class, outright wins in 2015 at Le Mans and Petit Le Mans in a GT car. That was an unbelievable race. 2018 Sebring 12 Hours GTLM, Nürburgring 24 Hours the same year, Petit Le Mans GTLM. 2018 was rather good, wasn't it?
It was a good
2019 yeah. Sebring 12 Hours in the GTLM class, did it again the following year, also on the Spa 24 Hours, and Petit Le Mans in 2020 in the GTLM class. And then you started this year with as we say, with the Daytona and Sebring wins. It's an absolutely ludicrous list, to be honest. And actually, you could probably should have won Le Mans in 2017, I would say. And you and Simsy were doing the job in the Corvette in a couple of years back as well before you sideswiped by an MP2
car. Yeah, it's a few that have slipped away. That's right.
So, Gary.
I mean, you must pinch yourself. That we had the conversation after your 2020 Spa victory in the Rover Racing Porsche, which, you know, completed the...
It completed
four
my
times
set.
24, but
yeah, exactly.
In classes. And you said when you joined Porsche, you know, first time around, because you're now in your second stint, of course, in 13, your dream was to win one of them. And there, you know, I ran out of fingers to count the list as Kev ran through it there. And now you've won, you know, whatever it is, 12 or 13 or of these big races in class. And overall, do you sort of think, hang on a minute, how did that happen?
Every day. Yeah. Yeah. Well, not every day, because you don't, you know, don't think about racing every day. But every time
you do, come on.
I do. Just not my own racing, but
right.
It is like you say. You know, when I joined Porsche, I think I've told you before, Gary. It's like I'd look at the, you know, the resumes of my fellow factory drivers. And, you know, you'd see some of them like Timo, for instance, that had got, I don't know, a Nürburgring win or, a Spa win.
Multiple on him, of course.
Yeah,
Nürburgring.
Exactly. You know, and everyone had kind of got at least a win in one of these marquee events, you know. And, I mean, championships are one thing, but I don't know, I've always had a soft spot for these big major events. And like you say, it was always the dream to get one, to have that on my CV so that anyone that ever looks would look, you know, look up and read Nick Tandy, Petit Le Mans winner. And when it happened it was my first year with the factory. We won Petit in in 2013, and it was unbelievable. It was the culmination of everything that I ever wanted. But then, of course, you get hungry. You know, it leads to thinking, I kind of like this. I kind of like this winning and the feeling of, you know, that accomplishment. And your hunger just grows. And, you know, the trouble is the more wins you get, the more hungry it makes you, honestly. I guess that's why, I don't know, I guess it's partly why, you know, been able to be successful in multiple events.
Which we need to point out, actually, that, you know, we should point out that you're a versatile driver, because the Nürburgring and the Spa victories, and obviously class victories at the wheel of GT machinery. And of course, now what we're talking about this year, the Triple Crown, the outright Triple Crown, or as the Americans would say, the overall Triple Crown, is at the wheel of prototype machinery. So that, I think that's important to say, isn't it?
Well, and also an LMP1 car from 2015 is very different to your LMDH car from even the prototypes of
very different.
but Nick, I mean, obviously you have won races other than these big events, obviously, and we're focused on these. Do you think that you pull something extra for the big event? Do you think you rise to the occasion?
No, I think my input, and I mean, you learn more as you. You know, you get more experienced and you understand what creates success. And I think the underestimated part of it, and I think a lot of teams and manufacturers underestimate this as well. I mean, now I kind of recognize, but at the time it was just natural. I think I work hard to try and build a team and to build a team mentality. And I think my input is also into helping the team become a team to go racing in these longer races. It's more to do with the teamwork and everybody, the driver crews being able to believe that you're going to win. Because if you don't think you're going to win, you're never going to win. I can only assume that I try to have a positive impact for everyone in the crew that goes on to what creates success in a long race. So, you know, I think there's part of that is what leads to success. And yeah, I think a lot, like I say, a lot of people underestimate, I think, you know, the role that each person has within the team to creating an environment where everybody, A, believes they can win, and B, wants categorically not to lose. So I guess that's why, you know, part of the reason why, yeah, in these longer events, the team aspect side of it comes into it more.
Yeah, it's a very good point. And just before we move on to focusing on this season and this year's Le Mans in particular, of those classics that I just read out, is there a one particular one that stands out for you as a particularly memorable moment or a great drive, or you know, do you have a highlight, or is it just the racking them up and doing that team building, like you say?
I mean, they all have their own stories. I can recount, you know, there's Sebrings out there where there's just unbelievable stuff happened and we ended up winning, or you know, that Spa race when the gearbox blew up with a lap and a half to go, or of course the whole, I mean, Le Mans, when we won Le Mans, it was probably the most kind of locked in win of the lot of them, but the work from that came way before the actual race. So I mean, they're all different. I mean, Petit Le Mans in the rain in the GT car, that will always stand out because there was so much shit going on that race that weekend, and so much stuff that could have derailed what happened in the end. And to win that Petit overall and beat all the prototypes on pace, you know, that will always stand out as one.
Yeah.
But like I say, you can, there's stories from the Nürburgring. Like I say, there's all sorts of stuff. I remember we won, like, again, a Petit in, I think it was 18, we won the pedal box. We had a sliding pedal box. the pedal box broke halfway through the race. So it was okay. I think Patrick and Fred, they were right foot brakers anyway. So, but we had to hold the pedal box fully forward with your left foot the whole time and brake. But I was a left foot braker. So halfway through the race, I had to change from left foot braking to holding the pedal box forward with the, you know, your left foot and then braking with your right foot. And it, you know, every race has got its own story and its own kind of intricacies, but
yeah, that's the height of adaptability. That is, I have to be careful mentioning your 2015 Le Mans win in the house, because if you remember, you said to me at your wedding, the December before, God, I fancy my chances at Le Mans. I reckon it could be good. And I'm not a betting man, but my wife said, go on, do it. And I didn't. And I really should have done.
Yeah, there you go.
Because well, she's just appeared and he's looking at me now.
A lot of my mates made a lot of money that weekend.
Oh yeah,
what kind of odds did they get?
It must have been enormous.
We were 11-1, Gary. When they got the best bets on. And bear in mind, realistically, there was only six cars in the race. The three Audis and the three Porsche were quick, and we were 11-1.
Oh, right.
So my mate put 100 quid or 200 quid on.
Oh, right. Yeah,
good work.
Did he buy you a pint afterwards?
He did, yeah.
I should blooming well think so. Well, let's fast forward 10 years. So I can't believe it's 10 years ago. And obviously, so the IMSA campaign has started, you know, brilliantly, as well as those, you know, the two big wins. You've got your three wins out of the five, leading the championship with Felipe Nasr. For people who are following sports car racing in Europe, Porsche, the Penske Porsche team, not having a great time in the World Endurance Championship. So how is it, you know, how is it that you're having such a great season? Because your sister car won one of the races as well, well ahead of the opposition at the moment in the points. How are they having such a good season in IMSA and then WEC? You know, same basic car, not delivering at the moment.
We have the best drivers in IMSA. That's the main
thing. you've put your pressure on yourself for Le Mans now.
Yeah, why not? I don't know. It's difficult to tell. I mean, we won Sebring because we had a fast car at night. But kind of all the other races, you know, we've won by team execution and, you know, not making mistakes and just being the best team on pit lane on the racetrack. So the car has been reliable, which has been a big step forward. You know, there's been, I haven't followed it too much, but from what I understand, you know, the tracks and some of the conditions haven't suited the WEC, the WEC team too much. As well as last year, but we've just been executing 100% in IMSA so far. And the thing is, in IMSA, you know, if you do have clean races and you have good strategy, even if you're not on pace, you tend to have a chance. You know, you can always roll a dice. And we saw at Detroit, the cars that qualified, I think, sixth and eighth, by 40 minutes into the race, so first and second. So, like I say, there's always something you can do, and it's a lot more down to execution and you know, not making mistakes, because it's very easy to do in IMSA. And it's just been an awesome start to the season. To win the first two of Daytona and Sebring is just an unbelievable thing. You know, you never think that's going to happen. But then to go to, where do we go, Long Beach? We won there as well. It was just... But it seems like you think coming to Le Mans, you know, you're never going to win all three. But we've had such an amazing run to start the year. It's like, why not? Because anything's possible. You shouldn't be able to win two races in IMSA in a row, let alone four. So it's like, why not come here and win Le Mans as well? If it's our year, maybe it's our year.
Yeah, nice. I mean, Gary, have you got any? I know you've done some work on, for example, Wayne Taylor Racing having to make some tweaks going from IMSA to their Le Mans debut. So what differences are there, if any, between, you know, the cars that are running? Because they are essentially the same.
Well, it's just that, you know, apart from sort of some electronic systems sort of between FIA and IMSA, sort of different sort of, you know, circuits and the way stuff is, data is measured, it's really just a small aero homologation thing, because the cars were originally homologated in different wind tunnels. The sort of the WEC spec car and the IMSA spec car. So it is really tiny. You know, if I look at the WEC so far, I'm not saying that Porsche should have won races or even been on the podium. But I think if you look at Toyota, you know, Toyota has struggled in qualifying, but it's strategically has been on the money and has pulled out some great results. If you look at Porsche in the WEC, strategically, it hasn't been on point, I would say. You know, sometimes that's just luck, the way it works out with safety cars. And, you know, you take a gamble, don't you? And gambles sometimes pay off and sometimes they don't. And I think probably Toyota's pushed the boat out a bit and that has paid dividends for them. So I don't think it's quite as bad for Porsche as it looks. You know, if you look at the points, you'd look, you know, these are the reigning champions and oh blimey, they're nowhere. But it should have been a bit better for Porsche. But on the other hand, you know, they haven't been in the game in terms of fighting for victories. And pertinently with Ferrari, which of course has made a clean sweep of all the races, all the free races in WEC so far this year.
Mm-hmm. Now, Nick, you mentioned about how important it is to, you know, to build a team. Obviously, you've got a new co-driver joining you in Felipe and Pascal Wehrlein. Obviously, the parallels there. He's coming from Formula E single seaters, and Nico Hülkenberg, when you won with him in 2015, was coming from F1. So, how much of an opportunity have you had so far to build a relationship with him and kind of get him into the same kind of team spirit that you and Filippo have obviously already got?
Not a lot, which is the problem. Well, it's not a problem. You know, we obviously know Pascal well from our time at Porsche. You know, we had a week in Germany, the whole factory team. We spent a week together in Germany on sort of team camp, and we talked a lot there, obviously, you know, about what was going to happen at Le Mans. The difference, like in 15, when Nico came on board, we did a lot of testing together because, you know, we were part of that extra car was part of the WEC team and operation all the way up to Le Mans. So the three of us probably did more testing in the car than any other driver crew that year.
Don't forget that testing was free that in those times, yeah, wasn't
exactly,
it? You know, now it's so strictly controlled and limited.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, we've yet to do a test together. That's the thing. Me and Felipe have been, obviously, a lot of our testing is done in the States because we've only got a limited amount of manufacturer days. You've got a limited amount of team days in either series. And Pascal has been testing, of course, but he's been doing the WEC stuff. And yeah, it will be the first time we've shared a race because he came out to do Daytona in the JDC Porsche, but we've yet to share a car altogether. So this Sunday, the test will be the first time we share a car. So it's a bit different. Not that it'll make any real difference, because like I say, we all know each other well. But yeah, it's quite different to how the whole build up to 15 kind of worked. So yeah.
In terms of sort of setup preference, you know, you've obviously looked at what he likes and you know what you like. You sort of have you made some of those decisions already, you know, going into the test day?
No, we haven't, honestly. You know, the thing is, we until you know how the car is, until you know how the tire is working and this sort of thing, that depends how the car, you need to set the car up. And at that point, then you'll start to assess different drivers' styles and wishes and stuff. But, you know, honestly, what we do know is the first five rounds so far in IMSA, the good thing is me and Felipe have been on exactly the same page. there was times even last couple of years where with teammates, it wasn't always you would have a compromise, which is normal. But this year in, you know, in IMSA at least, it has been really straightforward. The pair of us kind of know, you kind of know what each other's thinking, which probably helps, you know, the success we've had so far. So, yeah, I mean, we're just hoping that Pascal will be along those lines. And from what we know, he will be. You know, he's done a lot of driving, obviously, in DTM, which I would think is, you know, I would say the DTM cars, I did test a DTM car, but I'd say, you know, it's probably more with the weight that's involved in GTP or hypercar, shall we call it. The weight that's now involved is probably more similar to the DTM driving than, I don't know, like Formula One or maybe Formula E or even LMP1. So, you know, he's got that background as well to count on, which is good.
A lot of drivers have commented on that the cars are quite similar to, you know, the sort of final evolution of DTM cars, which, you know, were to all intents and purposes were prototypes, weren't they?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Big power, but a lot of weight. That's the thing with these hypercars. There's so much weight to manage. And once you, yeah, if you fill it with fuel, they're nearly as heavy as a GT car. So it's, yeah, they're a lot different to a P2 car or a P1, that's for sure.
You mentioned there, obviously, that you and Felipe are very much on the same page. Is part of that because have you got similar driving styles then? I mean, I remember speaking to you years ago and you saying how similar El Bamba's traces used to look to yours. Like you could match them up nicely. Is it a similar thing with Felipe?
From that regard, it's probably not quite as similar. So it's like every driver has a different way of achieving lap time. And like you say, me and Earl were very similar in what we did. I mean, Felipe is very similar. But, you know, if I saw a data trace, I could pick out the you know, which driver's which. The thing with it is we both look for the same thing out of the car to achieve the lap time. So it's like, you know, some people can, if you can deal with the entry oversteer, then, you know, your main concern will be that the car, you know, doesn't rotate in the center of the corner. And at that point, you'll be looking for more and more front end, which tends to be the same thing that we kind of look for. Whereas you get some drivers that drive slightly differently, and then they generate more ability for the car to rotate in the center. So then maybe they're looking for more entry support or more traction and this sort of thing. So from that regard, it's working well. Yeah.
Yeah, nice. Now Gary, we've mentioned obviously Pascal Wehrlein joining that crew. Le Mans does have a pretty decent history of drivers coming in and in those sorts of situations and doing well.
Porsche drivers specifically.
Yeah, and launching, in some cases, launching pretty reasonable careers.
Well, one I will mention is perhaps a parallel is Laurent Aiello coming into the winning car alongside Alan McNish and Stefano Ortelli in 88. And that was a bit of a late call. And he'd never actually done Le Mans before. He had done the test day, but he hadn't done Le Mans, ends up winning the race. That's in the lovely 911 GT1 98, which I think is a beautiful looking car. Now, go back a year, and a certain driver we've mentioned already, Tom Christensen, came in to drive the Porsche, so the Yerst Porsche WSC 95, came in to drive that car at day's notice. It was the corresponding day of the race meeting to today that he went to Yerst for a seat fitting in a spare tub they had. So the race car had already left for Le Mans, and he actually went on the Friday. And in those days, the test day was back at the end of April. So he did not get in the car until Wednesday. When I say get in the car, he did not drive the car on the circuit until the Wednesday of the race, and of course went on to win that year in that car. And obviously that was the start of an amazing sports car career. And just to point out that he wasn't actually a Porsche driver, because that year Porsche were not a factory team. In fact, the factory was a sort of, I wouldn't say hostile to them, but they certainly didn't want them there, because they wanted the 911 GT1 to win. The GT1 Evo, which was the predecessor of the sort of carbon car we were just talking about in 98. So yeah, so sort of ringers at Porsche have a very good history.
Yeah, there you go, Nick. So Pascal's got ages compared to that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so that's all right.
Loads of prep time.
Yeah. So, and the other great story about Christensen is that he was contracted to race in Formula 3000 with a team called Autosport International, with a bit of a copycat name, I might say, but an Italian team that sort of had some success for some while. And he was actually, you know, he didn't have to take a budget to them. So he was sort of, you know, I think he was getting paid to do Formula 3000, but they had a test at the A1 ring during Le Mans week. So he had to fly out of Le Mans, go and test his 3000 car, and then come back. So that actually limited the number of laps he got before the race still further, which is pretty amazing, really. And then he sets a sequence of fastest laps during the night, culminating in a new lap record. So, I thought, that's not bad.
No, that's pretty good going, isn't it? Well, I know that obviously, Nick, your focus is obviously on Le Mans at the moment, but looking just a bit beyond, are there any other big races that you've got on the desire list, the bucket list?
Daytona 500.
Oh, right. Okay. Oh, here we go. We got quite a long way in before you've managed to mention NASCAR. I should have expected that, shouldn't I? That might be difficult to do that in a Porsche.
Well, yeah. I've kind of given up on that dream as well. It's just too far out of reach. I don't have enough cash. I've got to bring a bucket load of cash if I want to drive a stock car professionally. If anyone wants to sponsor me,
have you not pointed out your mini stocks?
Call
pedigree.
Kevin Turner, Autosport editor.
Can I just point something out that, back in 2000, when you won Spa outright with Rover Racing, the Spa 24 Hours, that was in COVID year, of course, 2020. So the race was put back, and it was actually put back to the day the clocks changed. And there was initially a plan for it to be the Spa 25 Hours. So it started and
God,
finished.
It wasn't.
Well, yeah. So had it been, would you have the quadruple crown, which I'm calling the tan slam, you see, I'm not sure it's going to catch on, but I think
I like it.
Tan slam is good. I mean, would we still count it? It's an interesting one, isn't it?
I don't know if that car would have done another two laps. I mean,
right.
It had got no oil left in the box.
I remember you telling me.
It was a hole the size of, it was a fist-sized hole in the side of gearbox casing where the main diff, one of the main diff gear teeth had shit itself out the side of the gearbox. So,
you were quite emotional at the end of that race, I remember.
Oh, yeah. It was emotional. It was, yeah. Because I've been trying to win this race for, you know, a number of years, and we got...
Actually, you hadn't, because that was only your third.
It was. But I wanted to... It's getting in a good car. That's the thing. It's no point going... Well, I mean, it's great to race, of course, but if you want to win, you want to be in a car that's capable of winning. And it wasn't often that there was too many, you know, good Porsches in the race. But, you know, we went the year before, the 2 years with Rove, obviously a, you know, real good team. And we should have won the year before. You know, we had the best car. And I think, you know, we didn't take enough risk as a team to try and win. Yeah, I mean, it was a very long race and it looked like we were going to win that, obviously, the year that we did, which was going to be awesome. And then all the stuff happened with the gearbox, and I thought it was just going to be taken away from me right at the very end. And when we crossed the line, it was emotional, to say the least.
You look stressed about it even now.
Yeah, exactly.
Reliving it.
Here's another one I'm going to throw
in. That noise, I can just hear that noise. Oh, my God, what is that? Oh, it was horrendous. Yeah. It sounded like the thing was about to explode.
Another race I'm going to throw into the equation. What about the Deser du Norfolk at Snetterton, of course, which is a round of the Enduro Car Club Championship, which
it
of
always
course
clashes with Le Mans though. So, or
oh, is it this weekend? Is it Le Mans weekend?
It normally clashes with something.
Oh, does it?
Before, but yeah.
Oh, right.
What I do want to take part in, you know, I'm very unlikely to win it, but I've always prized myself that I'll try and get in the National Hot Rod World Final.
Oh, really?
So I grew up on the short ovals in the UK, obviously. I grew up watching, and the National Hot Rod World Final at Vauxhall Stadium, Ipswich, was the highlight of, you know, it was the highlight of my life. Every year going to watch and, you know, watching my dad try and race there and try and win. And yeah, the event was just, it was the center of my world for years and years and years before I ever knew what Formula One was or what NASCAR was or, you know, heaven forbid what Le Mans was. And it's, you know, it's still a massive, massive thing for stock car racing in the UK. Is the highlight weekend of the year, the speed weekend at Ipswich. And yeah, I'd love to be able to go there, you know, qualify on merit through doing the points series. Obviously I'll have to be not racing much other stuff, but I'd love to be out there listening to the rolling lap music in a hot rod sat there on the world final grid.
No, we'd have to come along if you do. Well, you got to let us know if that comes together. Excellent.
One day.
Indeed. Well, we were just before we finish, Nick, we were saying that, of course, if you do get your calendar triple by winning Le Mans, we're then going to have to start asking you about whether you can do the calendar quadruple by winning Petit as well. So the conversation won't go away.
Yeah. Well, exactly. You know, if you win one, then what do you do for the next one? You can't just settle down. You try and win the next one. So we're going to try and win everything. We could have won all five races in IMSA so far. It's just been one of those years. So why not? Like I say,
yeah,
why not?
Absolutely. That seems like a pretty good place to finish, Gary, unless you've got anything you'd like to add.
I'm done.
There we go. Well, thank you very much to Nick Tandy for joining us. That was a pleasure to look at some of those crazy races. Best of luck, of course, with both the test and, of course, the Le Mans 24 Hours itself. Hopefully we will catch up with you again later in the year. Thanks very much to Gary Watkins. I'll let you go and pack now so that you can go and join Nick out in France.
The washing's got to go on in a minute.
Yeah. And thank you very much to you, the listener. We'll be back soon with another All Sport Racing podcast.